Worried about letting someone else pick out the perfect avocado for your perfect impress them on the third date guacamole? Well, good thing Instacart shoppers are as picky as you are. They find ripe avocados like it's their guac on the line. They are milk expiration date detectives. They bag eggs like the 12 precious pieces of cargo they are. So let Instacart shoppers overthink your groceries so that you can overthink what you'll wear on that third date. Download the Instacart app to get free delivery on your first three orders while supplies last. Minimum $10 per order. Additional terms apply.
Glad that you're hanging out with me. I'm Lawrence Holmes here with you until 10 o'clock. I'm really excited, too, about talking with our next guest. One, I just like the guy. That's first and foremost. Two, I got two pages of questions for the interview to talk with him.
Wow.
Three, he wrote an incredible book called Madison Street Station. And I want you to see that I have the copy of the book. And this wasn't one of those, the author sends you the copy of the book. Because that's what happens. You know, you do a sports talk show, people send you books. When I heard that you had a book out, I went and found the book and I bought it. Because of how good you've been to this show, I wanted my money in your pocket for the book. And I was not disappointed with what I got. Sam Fells joining me now here in studio. What's up, my man?
Thank you so much, Lawrence. Those are kind words.
They're true words. I really feel that way. I ordered three books, and I was just like, can I get through all three? I ordered them a couple weeks ago, and I'm like, I want to get through all three by the 4th of July. Now, it took me a couple extra days to finish your book, but I finished all three books that I ordered. So it's kind of a, you know, when I was a kid, we used to do this little summer reading list.
Summer reading list, yeah. I never got through them either.
Well, I did. I did because, you know, my mom don't play. And this was on my summer reading list. So I wanted to bring you in and talk about it. Madison Street Station. Let's start here, Sam Fells.
Please.
Why did you want to chronicle the rise of the Blackhawks?
Much like the reason I started the program, I couldn't figure out what else to do. I can't get a real job. So, I don't know, it just sort of came to me one day. As I said to you when I released this and to everyone before, it's my fever pitch. You know, Fever Pitch is my favorite book, or one of my favorite books. And I kind of wanted to see if I could just do one on my own. And here we go. You know, I attempted it, and I think it came out pretty well. And I think it's a good story of just the team. I mean, whatever we think of the team now or a few years ago, no organization has gone through anything like this, really. From how forgotten they were in their own city to being the number one team there for, you know, 20 minutes or whatever in 2015. And then everything that came with it. So I think it's a unique story in North American sports, at least. And I wanted to take my shot at seeing if I could write it in a way that was relatable to people from our seat, from the way you and I witnessed it. You know, or eyewitnesses standing outside gate three. And I thought it would make for a good story.
Here's the thing. I expected that.
Right.
Going into reading this book, I expected, okay, I'm going to get a little history, a recent history of the Blackhawks over the last 10 to 15 years. What I was not expecting was how much of you I was going to find out about in this book. And I honestly, it was really awesome to learn more about you because of this book. It's very personal.
Yes.
And I wasn't, like, that's the thing that kind of caught me off guard.
Right.
I expected, okay, Sam's going to be funny about the Blackhawks and I'm going to laugh and I'm going to, you know, turn pages and flip pages. But this really is as much about the Blackhawks as it is about your personal journey as a fan.
Absolutely. And I was like you. I didn't quite expect it to be as personal as it came out. I knew there would be personal chapters. Anyone who's followed our blog for years knows that I've been through some things. But as I wrote it, I mean, you know, when you're a kid, these things are so ingrained in you. You know, they're such events when you get to go to a game or you find a friend who you can talk about hockey with. So just talking about my life would naturally have hockey conversations in it or conversations about the Hawks. and just talking about the Hawks, like this book started out, it just kind of throws my life into it. Because if you're doing the fan story, the fan's perspective, well, these things play a huge role in our lives, whether we like it or not, whether it's a good thing or a bad thing at times, it's all of that. And so as I kind of kept going through it, it kind of just naturally developed that way. It might have gotten a little farther than I thought. I never thought I'd be making phone calls to my friends asking if it's okay if I use their name, and how many stories they all pop up in. But I think if you're trying to tell, I mean, I'm not trying to tell just my fans' story. I'm trying to tell what I think are a lot of Hawks fans' stories, and especially the Hawks, because of how much of a cult they really were for us. I think it's more ingrained in us than a lot of fandoms are. It really identifies who we are as people and kind of how we see the world, for better or for worse, than a lot of other fandoms.
Who did the illustration of you outside of Gate 3?
My cartoonist did that. Lawrence, you got the program, so you know. Jim Sergey is his name. He did all the cartoons for our program for 8 years. And so I asked him to do this one. I sort of gave him an idea of what I was looking for, and that's what he came up with first try. It's pretty perfect.
It is. It's even got the fingertip gloves that you end up referencing later in the book, which I think is is kind of hilarious. You wrote in the book, the name of the book is Madison Street Station, and I highly recommend it, that being a hockey fan was like being punk rock when you were younger.
Mm-hmm.
What's it like now?
Well, I mean, that's a metaphor that my compadre on the blog, faxesfromuncledale.com, Matt McClure, wrote a long piece about that. It still feels that way, but not as much. It's a little more mainstream, especially in this town, but because I've been a fan for so long, and not just because I wrote about them or have a blog or whatever, I still feel like it's an identifier in some ways, again, for better or for worse. It doesn't feel as cultish or as outsider as it once did. You see way more Hawk stuff now than you ever did. But it feels more like being a Bears or Cubs fan. But because of the history that those of us who've been fans for our lifetimes have, there's still that twinge of uniqueness, I'd say, but it's not as strong. But it's different. You know, things change as you get older. All the bands I like are popular too now. So that's just how it goes, right?
I don't mean to play psychologist,
mm-hmm.
but when I was reading it,
take a number.
I mean, look, there were a lot of things like, wow, you know, that's kind of interesting. You said in there that when you wanted to start the Blue Line again, mm-hmm. the old publication, I kept wondering, and I wrote down, did you need to start at that point in your life where you were and doing the comedian thing and being away from Chicago, did you need to start it again? Was it a life change as much as it was you expressing your love for hockey?
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, yeah. I mean, it wasn't a need. It was just, when I thought of it, as I said in the book, it's kind of like a tuning fork goes off. You know, it just made so much sense. Like, everything suddenly was in context. Like, I wrote, when the Hawks or the Cubs won last year, the Hawks won their first cup. Like, everything up to that suddenly has a new context to it. And when I thought of it, and I got in touch with the old Blue Line writer, Mark Weinberg, everything just lined up. Everything fit together. So I guess I could say, yeah, I needed to do it, but it just felt like the perfect thing at the perfect time for me. And I know that a lot of people never get that, never find exactly what they want to be doing or should be doing at that time, what they're made to do. Now, it sounds silly that I was cut out to write this hockey rag standing outside selling it to, you know, fellow functional alcoholics. But like, I mean, that was it, you know, at the time. Like, that's what came to be. And I certainly couldn't have had it work out better. But yeah, I mean, I definitely felt adrift in L.A. and to come back home and do this for people I felt I identified with. You know, at the time, Hawks fans were still, you know, 2008, we still weren't mainstream. It still wasn't, they were still kind of the new thing. And to do this for people who grew up the same way I did, reading the Blue Line, standing in the standing room of the stadium, to sort of try and be a spokesman for them or a voice, how could I turn that down?
How did going to your first Hawks game change you?
It's a new slice of life at age 7, I suppose. I don't know. It's just, you know, up until that age, you feel a little sheltered and protected. I've been to a couple Cubs games by then, but that's, you know, the atmosphere is different. And this was something that had been built up, you know, as a coliseum of sorts, a really raucous place. And knowing finally getting to look at it and see it, and then feeling like you were doing something that the other kids in your class weren't and hadn't and wouldn't be allowed to. I don't know. It probably set me on this path to try and always be, you know, a little more punk than the group I hang out with. I mean, I probably should stop saying that at age 36 and grow up, but I kind of needed to always be fed this kind of thing that was outside the lines, that was not exactly, you know, prescribed for kids my age or where I grew up or who I was going to school with. So it was kind of this need, you know, and that's why I started listening to all the bands I started listening to, or the shows I watched, or the comics I read. And that, you know, still these days, you know, I still like to seek out new music. I still like to find new things that aren't in the mainstream. And I think having at such a young age and getting to this place that like had only been like whispered about, you know, when I was that age, kind of just started that sort of desire for me.
I don't want to give away too much because I want people to go and get the book, and there are already people that are asking how can they get the book. So how can they get the book?
There are various ways. Amazon has the Kindle and the paperback copy, which Lawrence has right in front of him. You can get it on Barnes & Noble for your Nook. You can get it on iTunes. We're working on Google. They're a little slow, but those are the main ways. There's a lot of other ways. If you just go to our website, faxesfromuncledale.com, there's a big button on the right side of the page. You hit that, it'll take you where you need to go.
The name of the book is Madison Street Station. The author is Sam Fels. He is here with me until 9 o'clock, and I've got a lot that I want to get through with him. How long did it take you to get the book done?
From sitting down and writing the first and last chapter, which I did first, to printing, was about 10 months. If I actually had a disciplined work ethic, it probably would have been shorter than that. But if I had a disciplined work ethic, I probably wouldn't have been writing a hockey program in the first place. So you take it as it comes. But yeah, about 10 months.
That's a different discipline.
Yeah,
that absolutely. We're talking about. So what did you find out about yourself in delving into book writing?
Sort of about my work ethic, I guess. I don't know that it's a different style. You know, it's not, I still write, I mean, the book is still basically in 700, 800 word bursts, because that's how I'm used to writing in blog posts or the sections of the program that we did. So I, you know, that's where I'm most comfortable, but it was heartening to know that I could take this and tell a story over a huge length of time for me. And even though it doesn't feel like a story, just talking about yourself as a Hawks fan at the start of it doesn't sound like a story. You know, you write your first chapter, you write your last chapter, and you connect them, and it is, you know, it has an arc to it. And to know that I could do that and make it have a constant theme or feel through it. I didn't know if I could do that. And I'm glad that people have found that I have.
It's interesting. It's there's a discussion going on Twitter, and Julie DeCaro and I were going back and forth. We were just discussing it, the concept of writing and how it's changed, and how there are a lot of companies now that are going by your model of no more than 800 words, definitely not 1,000 words. How do you think that writing has changed, and how do you try to get your point across without losing readers, because our attention span now seems to be about 500 or 600 words reading on a screen? In a book, it's different.
In a book, it's different. Ah, boy, that's tough. I mean, I think you said it. It's shorter attention spans. So I think you need to figure out what your point is a lot quicker. I know when we first started the blog and we would do our game wraps, we quickly just figured out that we didn't need to describe the action. You know, we didn't need to say, oh, here's who scored, when they scored, how it came about. We could get right to what we saw and what we thought, because that was the main point of these wraps. That was the idea that that was what we were providing that was unique. You could read anyone else and find out what happened in the actual game. And I think in a lot of ways, that's what blogging and blog writers have done, is we've found a way to get a lot of the times quicker to the point and cut out some of the superfluous stuff. But at the same time, some of that superfluous stuff is where the good stuff is. So it's good and bad. But yeah, I mean, I think it's, you know, weakening attention spans and shortening attention spans, I should say. And it's a lot more direct. You know, it's like Hemingway and Elmore Leonard, right to the core, you know, and don't just always say he said, never say he yelled or something.
I love the story in the book where you are enraged by Reg Kerr. Right. I was laughing out loud. And again, I'm not trying to give away your book. I want people to read it.
There are plenty of stories. So.
But you being enraged by his quasi April Fool's joke.
Right.
I got to know, what lesson did you learn from your first work stoppage as a fan? And why were you so mad at Redcar?
Well, who says I learned anything? I mean, that was after the baseball strike. So I guess I learned a lot of lessons from that. But yeah, looking back, my father, because every day I'd wake up and look for news, in the paper, trying to find out if the thing had ended. And I guess I learned that you have to have some patience with it. These things take more time than you want. But I don't know that I learned to control my emotions any better. I certainly tried to not direct them at innocent bystanders like Red Kerr, joking about the hockey lockout coming to an end on a Bulls game. But I guess when you're 14 or 13, you learn there are things in the adult world you just don't understand, and you grow up a little faster because these things are so beyond you. But I don't know that I still know that lesson fully today.
There were a couple of relationships that I was confused about. Because I don't know young Fells.
Right.
Okay. I know the Fells that's in front of me talking about the Blackhawks. So I know that you've had some pointed things to say about Pat Foley,
mm-hmm.
whether it's on Twitter or in the blog or even when you've come on and been on with me. I thought it was really interesting, though, that you make a point of talking about the Foley's call saying the Blackhawks were getting rid of the Red Wings. It was like a clarion call for you.
Mm-hmm.
And in your mind, is there a parallel there with the stair-stepping that the Bulls had to do, specifically with the city of Detroit, where it's like, oh, well, now we've gotten rid of the villain, this opens up the path to a championship?
Yeah, it's similar. I mean, at that point, the Hawks hadn't kept running into the Red Wings in the playoffs like the Bulls had kept running into the Pistons. Was it three times?
Yep.
So it's a little different, but like that rivalry was always there. Like one of the first things you learn about when you become a Hawks fan, even at age seven, is you have to hate the Red Wings with every fiber of your being. So, I hadn't seen them play I don't even know if I'd seen them play one playoff series before 1992. I certainly don't remember it. But it was sort of like, getting one over on the team that you need to get one over on most. It was more pushing away a brother or a sibling than it was conquering the stepping stone in front of you to be a champion like the Bulls were doing. Because the NBA has that, Celtics, then Pistons, then Bulls, Celtics, Sixers before that, I guess, if you want. Hockey didn't really have that because there was the Oilers and there was no getting past them. So it's similar, but it's a little different because it was just such a, in my mind, in a lot of Hawks fans' mind, it was such a blood feud, a blood rivalry that, having that call, like finally getting past them in a sweep and like embarrassing them in sort of way was so cleansing. It felt so good.
So how do you feel about Foley?
I mean, I still revere him. I mean, he's still those nights listening to him on the radio at home for the home games, as it was our only option. Those are still great memories. And I think now when the game is good, and it's fat, there's a lot going on, I still think he's great. I remember Taves scoring in overtime against the Blues in Game 5 in 2014. And his call of that is still perfect. Like, it's still the first thing I remember. When the game is good and he can punctuate the moments right, I still don't think there's anyone better. Maybe there was always the side stuff, the silly stories, which were always kind of there but have gotten more, the citing stats that don't matter. And when you're younger, you just don't notice. When you're writing about the game and you're trying to educate people, you notice more. He still means a lot. That voice still means a lot to me. And as much as I complain now, I like to complain, I don't think that'll ever change. I still think when he is actually calling the game, he's still one of the best. It's just, there's a lot more that comes with it now that's annoying. So you have to sort of take the good with the bad, I guess.
Sam Fells is here in studio with me. The name of his book is Madison Street Station. You need to get it. You can get it on Amazon. You can get it at Barnes & Noble. Just search for it and buy it. It's great. It's a lot of great Blackhawks stories through his perspective and his own personal journey, which I think is excellent. There's more I want to talk to him about. I haven't even gotten to page two. I got some dog ear pages in the book too, and I know that's disrespectful to the author, but I don't care because I needed to make sure I held my place. More with Fells coming up after a quick timeout. My name is Lawrence Holmes. You're listening to The Score.
Welcome to Play It, a new podcast network featuring radio and TV personalities talking business, sports, tech, entertainment, and more. Play it at play.it.
Thanks to Zach for the scoreboard update. Zach will be on tonight between 10 and midnight. We'll crosstalk with him around 9:45. Sam Fells is in the building. He wrote a book. Madison Street Station is the name of the book. You can find it on any of your online dealers for the most part. You should get the book. Even if you're not a Blackhawks fan, I think you'll dig it. I've got more questions that I want to share with Sam and get his answers on it. So,
I'll fire away.
How did the heartbreak of 92 change you?
Well, that was first true pain, I guess, because that was such a miraculous run. You know, they went on an 11-game winning streak, I think, in the playoffs, which is unheard of. And, you know, as you get older, you believe less and less about those magic things. You know, Bernstein would refer to it as baseball magic, and you see less and less of that. But when you're 11, 12 years old, and, you know, they come back against the Blues, they win 11 straight games, you know, your older brother comes home from graduating college right at the beginning of the final, you're like, this is all coming together. It's got to be, you know, it's meant to be. And to have it swept away so quickly, literally, was quite the crash. So I guess that was, you know, I cried after the Bears lost the NFC Championship game in 89, and then the Cubs lost in 89 as well. But that one, like, it was beyond crying. It was just like you were empty inside. You couldn't feel anything. And so, I mean, that's, you know, they never really got close to that again until 2009, 2010. So that was the first sort of heart being ripped out of your chest instead of just being sad or just being upset. Because it seemed like it was so meant to be, you know. The Cubs never really got close to the World Series. The Bears got stomped by Joe Montana, so it wasn't like you could feel it. You couldn't touch it. But that team, it certainly felt like that. You know, it was all there, and it just so quickly ripped away from you.
One of the things I loved about the book was that you went through these kind of flashpoints for the Hawks as a franchise, along with your own personal story in here. I don't know why I wasn't expecting it, but when I was like, oh, of course, this makes sense. I thought it was great that you went over the World Juniors in 2007. Why was that an important game in retrospect for the Hawks?
Well, it was the first time we all saw Taves and Kane on the ice together. And back then, the Hawks were so bad that it was the first time I and a lot of my fans my age had started really paying attention to their prospects in juniors and in college. And we'd started to look at the draft because we knew they were going to end up with a top three, top five pick. And so the World Juniors is really the only chance regular fans get to watch the kids who will be drafted or kids who have already been drafted. And so you needed anything to hang on to. And Taves had already been drafted. We'd already heard, you know, how good he could be. And then seeing Kane, and right about that time, he was generating, you know, buzz about being the number one pick despite his size. And to see the two of them, you know, at the time we didn't know because Kane hadn't been drafted yet. And we just only hoped, you know, he might end up on the team. But, you know, we really got to see Taves and the way he played. And, it, you know, you look back on it and it's like, you know, when you first were watching it and you thought, boy, if we could get these two together, we could have something here. Because, you know, Taves, when he was drafted, was all the message boards were lighting up. Like, we've really got something here. You know, this is a franchise difference making player. And so to finally see what he, you know, dominating on this international level amongst his peers at the time, it was like the first sign of hope, the first sign that things might be better in the not too distant future.
You write a lot about the inaccessibility of Bill Wirtz. Why was he so inaccessible?
Boy, that's probably a better question for a psychologist. I you know, the thing with Bill Wirtz is that all those policies were sort of, and Mark Weinberg talked about this a lot, they were sort of trying to hold on to his father's legacy. These were all things that his father believed in, the no TV, the way you treat, you know, your product and your fans and your players. And so there is something at the very base of it that I guess is honorable about it. But I just think he was just But man, the time just passed him by. He just didn't realize how things worked. Was very, you know, it always worked the way he had it before. So why change? He was still making money hand over fist with all his other businesses. But I think he's a very stubborn man. And I think when he stopped really being in charge and stopped making the decisions, people just didn't want to go against what he'd done before. It's unfortunate. God knows what this team could have looked like, this organization could have looked like if he'd modernized in any way. But he wanted to do things how his dad did them, and it worked for him. It worked for Bill Wirtz for a long time, and I think that's just how he saw things.
When you reflected on the reaction of Blackhawks fans when Bill Wirtz died, I thought it was really interesting, the way that you put it, that you were thinking about it like, yeah, it's awful that right. In a tribute, he got booed. But I think the line was, it's not like we booed him at the funeral.
Right. We didn't show up to the actual service. You know, they brought the service to us, even though I was in L.A. at the time. I think I was booing in my living room. So I don't think I could be any better. I would probably feel differently about it now. You definitely see things differently in your mid-30s than you do in your mid-20s. But I would still feel the same things. You know, I would still, like, we always said from every Hawks fan, well, when he dies, things will change. So we knew that when he did, that was the opportunity for things to be different than they'd been. So you're excited, and then you're angry that someone had to die for you to be excited. And then it's all these things about, well, God, I'm an awful person because it's just a hockey team. But, you know, I think, you know, that team had become such a part of our lives. It really was like a huge thing to us. And the way he treated it was sort of an insult to all of us. And this was like the only time we were going to get to voice our opinion to people who would care, because he wasn't like on TV. You wouldn't see him. He wasn't present like Rocky is now. You know, you wouldn't see him on the street or anything. And like, this was the final salvo. I'm not saying it was right. And I'm not saying if it happened again, that's exactly how everyone should react. But what's the Chris Rock thing? I ain't saying he should have done it, but I understand. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, so it's that sort of thing.
I enjoyed the way that you explored it. There's some other people in here I want to talk about with you, but we need to take a time out. When we come back, I want to talk about how John McDonough changed the Blackhawks for the good and maybe for not the good. Sam Fells, author of the book, Madison Street Station is the name of the book. It's awesome. Go pick it up. Back after this on The Score. In the middle of a conversation with Sam Fells about his book, Madison Street Station is the name of the book. It is worth your time if you're a hockey fan or a Blackhawks fan or not. I dog-eared a page in the book about midway through where you were talking about the hiring of McDonough. And I don't want to read the whole page, but I would like to read a little bit of the graph that made me dog-ear the page. The hardcore Hawks fans were certainly leery. While they rejoiced that the team was finally worth watching and that there was an owner who at least appeared to care about the team and fans, they certainly didn't want the United Center to become Wrigley West. We knew that McDonough didn't know anything about hockey, no matter what his pandering over the years would be, but he knew how to market a team, how to draw in more fans. We just didn't know what those kind of efforts were going to be. Was the wave coming to the UC? Would we be inundated with 20-somethings not watching the game and screaming the whole time? Were we going to get priced out of the arena altogether? No one views outsiders quite as suspiciously as hockey fans do, and McDonough was an outsider who might bring the whole host with him. We regard it to be polite. How do you feel about McDonough?
Now? Very conflicted. I still think in a lot of ways this Rocky McDonough regime, if you want to call it that, is very born on third, in that they took over and every core piece was already there. Everyone was drafted. The only thing left was Hossa, who came the next year with Talon as the GM. But at the same, so the main crux of McDonough's thing was, well, we need to win for us to be popular. That's job 1, 2, and 3. And they did that. And he's certainly worked with that as well as he can and done everything you would have dreamed of as a Hawks fan. But he's not responsible for the winning. and the people he's hired are questionably responsible for the winning. That's a discussion we have all the time. So when I hear people say, oh, they should teach a class about what Rocky and McDonough have done with the Hawks, I don't think what they've done with the Hawks is all that complicated. They inherited a team that was ready to win. They marketed their players. They treated their fans and players with respect. They put the home games on TV. They put some of them on WGN. What's so hard about that? Wouldn't anyone have done that? Now, I like some of the ways they've marketed the team. I don't like some of the others. We've seen when he's had a crisis to deal with, things do not go well. So I think he's very good at his job, but I think he landed in a spot that would have been really hard to screw up. And I don't want to completely dismiss their accomplishments over the past 9-10 years, but this was the most sweetheart situation to land in, not only because of the team you're getting, but because of how decrepit the organization was. There was nowhere to fall. Anything you did would have been an improvement. And I don't, I could complain about ticket prices raising, but that's what happens when a team wins, and they can justify that. But the things he's done, they look like a huge accomplishment because where the team came from, but I'm not convinced they're actually that complicated.
You, towards the end of the book, write about Patrick Kane.
Mm-hmm.
Starting with the cab driver incident. And I thought your reflection on how you reacted to it and how it was probably a warning sign that we didn't take seriously about Kane and his character, and I put that in quotation marks. What made you come to that realization, and why was that important for you to write?
I came to the realization like everyone else too late. It was after everything in 2015. And, when he first had gotten in trouble with that cab driver, we all kind of laughed it off because in a vacuum, it does sound really funny. It's not me he was punching. It's not anyone I know, over 20 cents, whatever happened. But that I don't know anyone who is capable of that, even at age 20. So when you look back on it, and you think, man, the organization or someone should have been looking at this a little more seriously than they did, but I think they knew that everyone would just blow it off because of how well he was playing, and we did. And that's exactly what happened. Now, maybe some things went on behind the scenes that public doesn't know about, that I've only heard about, that you've probably only heard about, that we won't get into. But it felt like, when you look back on it, you see how they played it, that like, okay, in a month's time when training camp begins, no one's going to care because everyone's so excited about this team. And that's what happened. And then you look back on everything that happened and you feel a little complicit. So it's all a train from that summer, from 2015. You look back, Madison, Wisconsin, to the cab driver in 2009, to everything in between that we hear about, that we kind of know about, that have happened here and elsewhere. And you sort of feel like, man, if we'd paid real attention then, could we have headed it off? But it seems such a minor incident at the time. And for a lot of people, it would have been. But it took 6 years before I was like, that's what was really going on here.
I don't want to let you leave with that kind of being the footnote to our discussion. Although I will say, you need legal advice by a reputable attorney. Send questions you want answered to cbschicago.com/legal advice. Look online for free Legal Fridays with Horowitz, Horowitz and Associates. That's cbschicago.com/legal advice. Knowing you a little bit, We're not great friends, but I respect you and I know you.
Hey.
We're not great friends. Okay. You never just come and hang out. You're always invited. I have to tell you that there is a portion of this that almost brought me to tears. And it'll be different for other people because they'll relate to it in a different way. The story of you finding out from your brother that you have season tickets. I thought it was wonderful. You describe it as a lifelong dream coming true to be a season ticket holder for the Hawks and trying to figure out like how are you going to make this work. Take me back to that moment when your brother says, I got it, and we're going to be season ticket holders.
Well, it was strange. It's another chapter that's kind of almost lifted directly from Fever Pitch. Not directly, but it's heavily influenced because he talks about when he moved to North London for the first time and was an Arsenal season ticket holder, he had this image of flinging open his door at the same time all his neighbors fling open their doors, and they're all wearing their scarves, and they all walk together. And that's sort of what it felt like as I dreamed as a kid of being a season ticket holder, that you'd have this pack that you always approached with. And when I decided to start the Committed Indian or restart up the Blue Line, everyone I talked to was so supportive. My dad could not have been more excited because he just supported me in anything I did. My friends all thought it sounded like a great idea. My brother Adam was a little more guarded, and he had a pro and con list that he took a week to like put together. So he was supportive, but you know, it wasn't full sellout. You should do this. You know, he was, but at least that's how he sold it to me. So when he, you know, when I called him like, hey, I think I might need to get season tickets, and he says, I've already taken care of it. It was him basically saying, I know you can do this. You're going to be great at this. This is my investment in you. And, you know, you're brothers. You don't talk to each other that way most of the time. He and I eventually did. So to have that from him, it's like the final piece. It's like, all right, if my family and my friends are so behind me in this way, I can do this. Like, this is going to be a success. It's going to work. And, you know, to have that from him, he didn't make a ton of money. It was a big investment for him. It was like the final push to start all this and to, you know, be the Committed Indian and now Factors from Uncle Dale and Second City Hockey and the program. So it was, you know, it's a really affirming, heartening moment that when I think back on it, it's like, yeah, okay, now we jump off the cliff because we have this net.
I love this book, Sam.
Well, thank you.
I truly do. And people who don't understand your love for hockey, just know this, and I don't want to spoil it, but in the book, Sam tells a story about literally bleeding to give you your hockey news.
Yep, I bled on all the programs
outside of the United Center.
Yep. You can't get more hockey than that.
No, it really doesn't. And even more that you didn't realize it. No, like, that's like
no
super
idea.
Hockey,
right?
What you're talking about
it was
right
so
there.
So cold, I didn't realize I was bleeding on all the programs. But you'll have to read about it.
The name of the book is Madison Street Station. Tell them again how they can get it.
You can get it basically by going to our website, faxesfromuncledale.com. There's a big button on the right. You can go through Amazon, Barnes & Noble, iTunes. You go to our Twitter feed, which is at RealFansProgram. It's the first pinned tweet. So you can; those are all the avenues you can get. You can get it for your e-reader. You can get it paperback copy like Lawrence has right here. If the camera were on, they would see that. And those are all the ways you can get it. And please do, because people are looking for me. And I don't know how much longer I can outrun them.
Please buy Sam's book so that they don't come and take him away. At least not yet. And it's really, really good. Sam, thank you so much for coming down and dealing with the farmer's market. And
it was close.
To duck dive and dodge all the stuff that's going on there. And I hope that this isn't the last time you write a book.
Hopefully. That would be the dream. But thanks so much, Lawrence. I really, really appreciate this. You know how much fun I have coming down here. So this is, you know, my childhood. Well, not this station, not this physical one, but this station is you know, a huge part of my life. So to be in the studio is always a thrill.
Back when you were young, Sam.
Back when I was young, Sam, indeed. Fighting with young Jason.
That's right. That is very right. Now look at the two of you.
Now look at the two of us. Well, he's much more adult than I am now, so.
He got a baby.
Uh-huh.
Madison Street Station is the name of the book. Sam Fells is the author, and he's been our guest this last hour. We're going to take a break. When we come back, we're going to talk about NBA Jam. They did a first person like oral history of NBA Jam, and the author of that piece is going to join me next. It's going to be so much fun. This segment brought to you by the Drug or Alcohol Treatment Helpline. If you've got drug or alcohol problems and your loved one, you want them to get solved, with insurance, you can do that. Treatment may be at little or no cost to you. Call the Detox and Treatment Helpline now at 800-430-4149. He's heating up! Is next here on The Score.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.